Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, what the Upper Delaware Council's first state funding in more than 30 years could mean for the future of river management and local communities along the Upper Delaware. More fallout from Albany's least productive legislative session since the pandemic. We'll talk to New York Public News Network's Jimmy Vielkind for analysis of why the session stalled, what finally passed, and what it could mean for Governor Kathy Hochul in this month's primary elections and the midterms. Plus, we'll take you to the Hudson Valley's strangest street festival, the UFO Fair in Pine Bush. Aliens, cosplay, and extraterrestrial small-town pride. And writer and naturalist Erwin Carl joins us to discuss a plein air writing workshop at the historic John Burroughs Woodchuck Lodge in Roxbury after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israel says it reopened Gaza's main cargo crossing after shutting it for a day. It was closed after a missile exchange between Israel and Iran. NPR's Anas Baba reports from Gaza.
Karim Shalom crossing with Israel resumed operations Tuesday, allowing aid and commercial goods to enter Gaza once again. Israel says the crossing can handle hundreds of trucks a day and that this single entry point is sufficient to meet Gaza's needs. Gaza's border authorities dispute that, and UN figures show approximately 200 trucks enter Gaza daily. Monday's shutdown halted the flow of goods into the territory, even though Gaza was not involved in the fighting between Israel and Iran. Israeli authorities also announced plans to reopen the Rafah crossing on the Gaza-Egypt border for limited travel. But Rafah remained closed Tuesday, leaving patients, students, and other travelers still waiting to cross. Israel has repeatedly closed Gaza's crossing during periods of heightened regional tensions. Anas Baba, NPR News, Gaza.
Stocks opened higher this morning as the National Association of Realtors reported a modest uptick in home sales last month. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 400 points in early trading.
Sales of existing homes rose 3.2% last month, a small sign of life in what has been a lackluster housing market. The average price of a home sold in May climbed to just over $429,000. 35% of homes sold in May went to first-time buyers. That's a modest increase over April's share. Housing affordability is still a challenge, though, with mortgage rates averaging just under 6.5%. The benchmark price of crude oil in the United States is back below $90 a barrel. Retail gasoline prices dipped less than a penny overnight. AAA says the average price of regular gas is hovering around $4.16 a gallon. Asian stocks were mixed overnight. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
U.S. immigration officials have barred a popular Somali soccer referee from entering the U.S. for the World Cup. Somalia says he had a valid visa to enter the U.S. despite the Trump administration's travel ban on Somali citizens. NPR's Jewel Bright has more.
Omar Atan was stopped at Miami International Airport by U.S. Customs and Border Protection officers and repatriated to Turkey, from where he will return home today. U.S. Customs and Border Protection put out a statement without directly mentioning Atan, saying a Somali national was deemed inadmissible due to vetting concerns. Atan was named Africa's best referee last year, and he was set to become the first Somali referee to officiate in a World Cup tournament. The president of soccer's governing body, FIFA, previously addressed concerns around U.S. travel bans by saying teams and officials need to access any World Cup host country. Otherwise, there would be no World Cup. Drew Bright, NPR News, Lagos.
You're listening to NPR News. There are primary elections in four states today: Maine, Nevada, North Dakota, and South Carolina. They're holding contests for governor as well as local and national seats. Alaska's primary election isn't until August 18th. But Alaska's lieutenant governor says the state is investigating a retired teacher named Dan Sullivan. He recently filed to run for the U.S. Senate as a Republican. He's competing against Alaska's Republican incumbent senator, who is also named Dan Sullivan. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports the state's lieutenant governor and the incumbent senator claim the challenger is acting in bad faith.
Senator Dan Sullivan says Democrats are trying to cheat to win control of the Senate. But challenger Dan Sullivan says he's not colluding with any candidate or party. He says he's running because the incumbent doesn't represent ordinary Alaskans. And he says the fact that Senator Sullivan shares his name adds insult to injury. The lieutenant governor's letter asks him to answer, under penalty of perjury, 7 questions, including about his party affiliation. Alaska's open primary means both Dan Sullivans could advance to the November ballot, along with Democrat Mary Peltola. Alaska's ranked choice system lessens the possibility that any candidate can act as a spoiler. For NPR News, I'm Liz Ruskin in Anchorage.
NASA will reveal the next crew of astronauts for the Artemis 3 mission. This follows the Artemis 2 team that flew around the moon and back this year. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. The Upper Delaware Council is set to receive $100,000 from New York State, marking the first direct state funding for the organization in more than 3 decades. The council, which helps coordinate management of the federally protected Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River, has long argued that New York and Pennsylvania never fulfilled funding requirements envisioned when the organization was created. The UDC has operated primarily on a federal allocation that has remained largely unchanged since its creation in 1988. Joining us now is the editor of the River Reporter, Liam Mayo, with more. Liam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tim.
So this seems strange that it took 30 years for one of the states to fund the UDC. What exactly did New York approve for the Upper Delaware Council?
Yeah, so New York approved $100,000 in operational funding for the Upper Delaware Council. It was announced as kind of a co-package with the Friends of the Upper Delaware River, a separate organization that is a nonprofit that also sort of works on conserving the Upper Delaware River. And between them, they got $550,000, with the bulk of that going to Futter and this $100,000 allotment going to the Upper Delaware Council, which, kind of as you mentioned in the lead-in, is the New York State share of funding that the organization was originally supposed to get back when it was founded and just sort of hasn't gotten through the years.
And why have they been seeking support for decades? Why has it been such a long-standing issue?
I'm not entirely sure sort of what all of the barriers were to getting it like throughout the years. It was just something that wasn't done in the beginning, and it was something where the arguments for it just never sort of worked until now. In the past couple of years, the organization has really stepped up its efforts to secure that funding. With inflation, sort of the original, you know, $300,000 that it's getting from the federal government is meaning less and less. And it conducted a financial study that indicated in the next couple of years, if it didn't find some solution to its funding problems, the organization would have to cut full-time staff and kind of shrivel away into not really being able to fulfill its obligations under the river management plan. So it is something that members of the organization have really been pushing for sort of with redoubled efforts over the past couple of years, and have now sort of found this success, at least on the New York side.
And then who was key in securing this funding? How did it finally come together?
Yeah, Kay was key in securing this funding.
Assemblymember Paula Kay.
Yeah, on the New York side. When she got into office, she was notified sort of by the UDC about the agreement between New York State and the UDC for New York State to provide them this funding. She said, quote, they sent me a copy of it. I reviewed it and it looked legitimate to me, but it had never been enforced. And Kay then arranged a meeting with members of the UDC and Assemblymember Deborah Glick, who was the chair of the Environmental Conservation Committee. And it was sort of that meeting that where the UDC was able to, you know, make its pitch for that $100,000 that it had originally been promised. And that meeting and that sort of partnership that ended up getting that funding across the finish line and having it be something that ended up in the New York State budget.
And have there been discussions about how the $100,000 might be used?
Yeah, this was something that the UDC discussed at its June meeting, where it's not entirely sure right now how that funding can be used. It's something where the, you know, exact details of it are going to come down to the work with New York State. I think they mentioned, like, it's not going to be as simple as the state, you know, just cuts a $100,000 check and hands it over and doesn't track it after that. Like, the exact nature of the stuff is going to be, you know, determined by the exact wording of the contracts and everything. They also mentioned there's, you know, the possibility that there may be some limits on it based on the UDC being a, like, multi-state agency where it does work sort of on both sides of the river in New York and Pennsylvania. But, you know, that is just something that they're going to continue to work through as they get in contact with New York State about the specific funding.
And is there an idea of, like, how much $100,000 goes for an organization of this size? I mean, it is unusual in sort of the governance structure with federal, state, and local governments all involved in managing the river corridor. And even if they don't know how it will be used, is it a fairly significant amount?
Yeah, I'd say it's a pretty hugely significant amount. I mean, if you take an organization that's subsisting off of $300,000 and you add another $100,000 onto that, I can't do the math to know exactly sort of what percentage of that is, but that's a fairly substantial, like, increase. So that state funding will add up to, like, ultimately 1/4 of the organization's new funding. Say, you know, for an organization that has 2 to 3 staff members, that pays for a staff member position potentially. Again, not entirely sure what exactly that money will go to, but just to sort of talk about the import or how far that funding goes and how important that funding is. Like, the UDC is a size of organization where $100,000 is an incredibly significant amount of money. And which is why they've been pushing for it for all these years. And which is why sort of even with this $100,000, they're still going to be pushing on the Pennsylvania side to now try and get Pennsylvania to meet New York State and to also fulfill its promises and have this $100,000 share of the original funding that was promised.
I was going to ask, is there any news from Pennsylvania? What are folks saying about Pennsylvania's contribution?
No news from Pennsylvania yet. Just, you know, the organization has been trying to get that Pennsylvania funding over the years, the same way it's been trying to get this New York share of the funding over the years. And I think there's some hope that, you know, now that New York has acknowledged that, you know, this is a promise that went unfulfilled and should be fulfilled, I think there's some hope that that would encourage Pennsylvania to do the same. But there's no progress on that at this point to report.
And what are the UDC folks saying in terms of, like, just finally after all these years and this perseverance getting this funding?
Yeah, there's a lot of sort of congratulations to the people who were able to make this happen. There was a statement from UDC Executive Director Lori Ramey, quote, "Assemblymember Kay pledged to be our champion and catalyst for New York State to fulfill its fiscal requirement for the Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational Rivers management and maintenance, and she absolutely came through for us. This first ever state operational funding will enable the UDC to enhance its value and impact in the River Valley after struggling to survive on flat federal funding since 1988, and then sort of goes on to say we hope the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania will follow New York State's lead. And there's, you know, a lot of congratulations for the organization's perseverance in, you know, sticking at it and keeping on trying to secure this funding, despite, you know, this taking over 30 years to find success and to come through.
Pennsylvania, if you're listening, that's Lee Mayo, editor of the River Reporter. You can read his reporting about the UDC getting $100,000 in funding from New York State after more than 30 years at riverreporter.com. Liam, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Tim.
Still to come, New York's legislative session is over, but questions still remain about what lawmakers actually accomplished. We'll take a closer look at a session dominated by budget delays, the early adjournment, and a relatively short list of major policy achievements. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Vintage House, selling vintage clothing, records, books, and toys from the past. A walk back in time on Main Street in Jeffersonville, and at vintagehousejville.com, and from listeners like you.
I'm Stephen Dubner on the next Freakonomics Radio, how the great physicist Richard Feynman recovered after helping to build the atomic bomb.
He thinks there's no point in building anything, everything is going to blow up.
And how he started a new life out west.
At Caltech, he was a hero, right up to the end.
Part two of The Curious, Brilliant, Vanishing Mr. Feynman, that's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The New York legislature have wrapped up what appears to be their least productive session since the pandemic-era disruptions of 2020. The legislature adjourned shortly after 8 p.m. Friday, marking its earliest scheduled departure from Albany in 4 years as lawmakers headed home to campaign ahead of the June 23rd primary elections. While dozens of bills were approved in the session's final hours, much of the six-month legislative calendar was consumed by negotiations over New York's $268 billion state budget. The spending plan wasn't fully adopted until May 27th, nearly 2 months past the state's April 1st budget deadline. For more on what was accomplished, what wasn't, and what it says about the balance of power in Albany during Governor Kathy Hochul's tenure, Jason Dole spoke with Jimmy Vielkind of the New York Public News Network, who covers state government and politics from the Capitol.
Jimmy Vielkind, welcome back to the local edition.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going well, and I can imagine you've got a little bit more time on your hands now that lawmakers have totally left Albany. And I think your headline and opening sentence in your article say a lot, that they're heading home after the least productive legislative session since the pandemic lockdowns. Like, why is that?
Well, it's a couple of things, Jason. This session year was scheduled to end a little bit early always because lawmakers are really focused on primaries, both Republican and Democratic primaries, that are scheduled to take place on June 23rd. So the plan had always been to leave in this first week of June, which cut things a little bit shorter than they often are. And the second reason was that the state budget, which ended up being passed, and it's filled with $268 billion of all kinds of spending, it ended up running about 8 weeks past the April 1 due date. So because the budget stretched on for so long, Democrats who control the state assembly and Senate said they just didn't have time to really consider a big host of other issues that they normally would in the course of a regular legislative session.
Of course, back at the start of the legislative session, some of the conventional wisdom, or maybe it was just wishful thinking, was that, well, knowing that there was going to be primaries coming up, that it is an election year, that might also hasten the budget process. But it seemed like the governor in particular wasn't in like a huge hurry with getting through the budget.
No, not at all. No, she took her time. And because of the way the state government is structured, the governor really has an upper hand in terms of getting a stronger negotiating position in what policies can be baked into budget bills. So really what she did was just stall and stall and force lawmakers to engage on her terms. And indeed, the budget that passed did have a lot of policies baked into it. There are restrictions on how local police and state law enforcement can cooperate with federal immigration authorities. There were rollbacks to the state's 2019 climate law. And there were also new pension benefits for newly hired workers that were included in that budget. It was a very, very big, robust budget document. But again, it just sort of choked off time for when the legislature really gets to set the agenda.
Right. And while there's some legislative decisions, you know, baked into the budget, there's still other legislating that needed to be done. Budget was fully adopted on Wednesday, May 27th. Legislators adjourned on, you know, just on Friday night. So that leaves about, what, a week and a couple of days that they were able to do what they had to do. What was that last week like?
Well, it was a little frantic. You know, there were some bills that are non-controversial that have to do with things like renaming a highway. or reauthorizing a municipality to charge sales taxes. And they can crank through those bills very, very quickly. It's kind of funny to listen to hear these votes called boom, 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 one after the other. But then there were other things that came up that were really, really controversial. And Republicans who were in the legislative minority, when they had a problem with the bill, they knew that they could run out the clock and they could frustrate their colleagues in the Democratic majority and their ability to get more issues done. So it forced the Democrats to be more judicious about what they brought to the floor and what they didn't. At the same time, you had around the Capitol activist groups who were coming for last-minute rallies. There were people pushing to make it easier for municipalities outside of New York City to enact rent control. Their bill was not acted upon. We also saw people who were demonstrating to double the state's bottle deposit and also to enact a law that would try to reduce plastic pollution. They have been at it for years, but once again, their bill was not taken up this year.
Yeah, and I just want to underscore something you said there, because that wasn't anything I was expecting. I figured, you know, again, Republicans are the minority party in New York State and the New York State legislature. I figure if there's a mad rush to pass legislation, that would only further marginalize them. But it sounds like you're saying that actually gave them a little bit more leverage, if not just cold comfort.
They did have a little bit of leverage, yeah, because there are set limits for the amount of time you can debate a bill. And so just like in a sports match with a set clock, you know, you can basically hold the ball and run it out.
So you just mentioned a couple of things that just didn't get passed. They didn't get to any other notable items that were concerns to some lawmakers or some advocates that just didn't go anywhere?
There were two things that I was watching at the end of the session that both fell by the wayside. The first was a thought that there would be additional regulations on e-bikes. We've seen some high-profile crashes in New York City. They're becoming more and more common on streets around the state. And there was a push, which had bipartisan support from some serious lawmakers, to perhaps require registration or push for more and greater public education about what's legal and what's not legal with e-bikes. But Assemblymember Bill Magnarelli, a Democrat from Syracuse, told me that, hey, there just wasn't enough time to get this done in a substantive way. He says that he hopes that there will be something that comes up by next January when the legislature comes back. The other has to do with the resale of tickets to concerts and sporting events. Every year, the state has a law that basically legalizes ticket scalping. It legalizes the resale of tickets. And that's, of course, been important in the era of SeatGeek and StubHub, where people expect to be able to sell tickets for a kind of above face value. But in renewing that law, some lawmakers, most noticeably James Skoufis, the state senator from Orange County, he was hoping to insert some consumer protections onto the law. He wanted to cap fees and actually forbid the sale of tickets for more than face value. That's a big, meaty policy area. There are lots of concerns and lots of people weighing in. And Carl Hasty, the Speaker of the State Assembly, looked at it. He looked at the clock and he said, we're just not going to tackle this year. We don't have time. And so the law as it currently exists was just extended until 2027.
You know, the quote that you have in your article from Skoufis on this and other things I've heard from him, it seems clear that he's frustrated that this didn't go anywhere. But it also sounds like he's, you know, trying to be diplomatic about it because, it's his party in charge.
I think it's clear that he's frustrated. I also don't think it's perfectly clear that he has broad consensus around exactly what he wants to do. What I read in his bill is that it was kind of an opening bid for a conversation. And when the other people involved looked at the clock and they decided, we just don't have time to have this conversation this year, we'll try and do it next year. So I think he is frustrated. I think it's fair for him to be frustrated, but I think he has to be frustrated with the world, not one particular person or party. And I think that might diffuse some of his frustration.
So what did pass in the final week or so of legislation? Any notable policy things that did get done?
Yeah, there were three things that I think are the highlights of the end of this session. The first was a one-year moratorium on the development of large data centers. There have been concerns from both Republicans and Democrats about the use of power and therefore the impact on energy prices and utility rates for regular people that these data centers have. There were some concerns aired by developers of data centers as well as labor unions, but that bill did pass and it will go to Governor Hochul's desk, where I really don't know if she's going to sign it. The second piece of legislation that I think was pretty significant has to do with what's called surveillance pricing. Lawmakers pushed forward a bill that would prevent companies from using personal data about an individual to set a price tailored to them. This might perhaps let you charge somebody with a higher income a higher price, or someone who you know is desperate and buys these goods all the time a higher price. So business interests and companies argued deeply against this. They say it's going to impact loyalty programs. They say it's going to impact coupons. Supporters of the bill said that's nonsense. And so, again, this is a pretty meaty thing that is going to impact the lives and pocketbooks of New Yorkers if it gets signed into law by Governor Hochul, which, again, remains to be seen.
You know, even though there was so little time to pass many laws that they had on their docket, one thing that did get done is they started the process of making a constitutional amendment, which would be a pretty major thing in any session. But this is essentially New York entering the now nationwide redistricting wars, correct?
Yeah, that's right. So there was the first passage of a constitutional amendment that would let New York lawmakers draw a new U.S. House of Representatives map in time for the 2028 elections. We've already seen states like Texas and California and Virginia move forward with drawing new maps, but New York's state constitution specifically forbids mid-decade redistricting. So state lawmakers are just trying to amend it. But in addition to just letting that map-making process happen more frequently than the once a decade where it normally happens, they've also made major changes to the redistricting process in New York. They make it easier for legislators themselves to grab the map making pen from the state's current independent redistricting commission. And the amendment as drafted would repeal the prohibitions against partisan and incumbent gerrymandering that voters of New York put into the Constitution in 2014. So, yeah, a constitutional amendment, as I said, Jason, it's not an easy thing to get done. It can't actually get done until 2028 because it needs to be approved again by lawmakers in 2027. And if that happens, it has to go before the voters and they have to weigh in and say yay or nay during the 2027 general elections in November. I've talked to Republicans and Democrats and both sides say this is going to be a pretty big fight, because Republicans view this as a power grab, and Democrats say it's the next thing they can do to stand up to Donald Trump.
You know, as you report on Albany, this is the part where I'd like to just get into, like, just reactions from people, not just on what did or didn't get done, but how this process plays out in New York. Because I feel like I'm starting to hear some more questions or frustrations, even from lawmakers themselves, even from Speaker Hastie a couple of times in this past session. Are you hearing frustration from lawmakers, advocacy groups, or even constituents, either frustration with the legislative session overall, its length in New York State, or the fact that the budget process takes up so much time and oxygen?
Well, Speaker Hastie seems to be frustrated with the way Governor Hochul has approached budget talks. She seems content to stretch them out. I think that the governor has some guilt for that, but, you know, it takes not just two to tango, like Buenos Aires, and Albany, it takes three to tango. So if the speaker doesn't like that process, he did have something to say about it. And I think that in the future, he's going to be more assertive in getting that done. But yeah, you often hear frustration from activist groups of all different stripes that there's not enough time in the legislative session. But also, I think we should recognize that there's nothing precluding lawmakers to come back. They could be still at the state capitol this week considering bills and voting on them. They could come back in July. They could come back in September. They can come back at any time that they want. So it's a question of a will, not necessarily a rule or a law against it. And I think that's why members mostly have their frustration tempered, because they know it's within their power to perhaps take action.
You know, one lawmaker you spoke to that touched on this was Assembly Member Josh Jensen, Republican from Monroe County. I just want to play this clip quick.
We're at a place in the last week where we've had to put 100 pounds of policy and bills into a 5-pound period. And, you know, unfortunately, that means that some good public policy that has bipartisan support might not make it over the finish line.
So there you hear him talking about trying to get 100 pounds worth of policy into a 5-pound period of time. But Assemblymember Jensen is somebody that actually mentioned the possibility of coming back before the end of the year, right?
Thought it would be worthwhile. But again, he's a Republican from the Rochester area. That means that he's in the minority, and it's really a decision that he doesn't have a ton of impact on making.
And going back to where we started in the beginning, just talking about how this was the least productive legislative session, one of the ways that you determined that was talking to NYPERG was tracking like how many bills typically get passed. And they were also weighing in on this question of how things are done, right?
Yeah, that's right. It turns out that about 759 bills passed both houses this year. That is lower than last year. It's lower than any year since the 2020, when the COVID-19, really locked down the world in the latter part of the spring. And it's lower than the average number of bills that have passed during Kathy Hochul's tenure as governor, which is 891.
And you spoke to Blair Horner, the senior policy advisor for NYPERG, who, you know, was kind of, again, talking about the power that lawmakers have to affect this process.
The fact that the legislature only has 1 week's worth of time to do what they would normally do in 2 weeks' worth of time. And that is about how much time they allot themselves on the floor to debate bills. And at a certain level, you just overwhelm the system. You have so much pent-up demand, so little time. Issues that maybe are maybe necessary and needed, but are too controversial to gobble up a half a day to get it done, unless the leadership wants to do it. So far on redistricting and those kinds of issues, they make the time. But on issues dealing with things like a mere solid waste crisis, not so much time.
So there again, just talking about some of the factors at play here and talking about the leadership. How much, you know, the old saw is like the three men in the room, the three people in the room. Is that really still the way that things happen in New York, at least when it comes to the budget side of legislation, that it really is about Stuart Cousins, Hastie, and Governor Hochul?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, what we've seen is that the leaders negotiate with the governor. And within the houses, it's really the leadership, the speaker and the majority leader have the final say over what bills come to the floor and which ones don't. And based on the way things have worked in Albany for at least the nearly two decades I've been here, it's incredibly, incredibly rare for a bill to come to the floor and not pass. And so Speaker Hastie said very clearly, when he looks at a bill or he looks at a proposal, if it doesn't have the votes to pass, he's not going to bring it up and take it up for a vote.
Jimmy, you've been very generous with your time here, and I thank you for going over this reporting with us. Is there anything that you wanted to get to that we didn't mention yet? Anything you want to let folks to know to watch for?
Nope. I'll be watching in the next few weeks to see what happens in party primaries. And then we will see if there are bills that Governor Hochul is going to sign, bills she's going to veto, or bills that she's going to try to come to a side agreement that would maybe change or tweak them to get her signature. So we'll be probably doing that for the next several months, and then we'll start again in January.
All right. Well, I thank you again for taking the time for talking to us.
Thanks, Jason. Always a pleasure to be with you and your listeners.
Jason Dole speaking to the New York Public News Network's Albany Bureau Chief Jimmy Vielkind of WNYC. And a little bit more news from the New York Public News Network. SUNY's chancellor says the State University of New York system remains strong despite federal actions targeting higher education. Samuel King with the New York Public News Network reports direct state support is up by almost $500 million over the last 4 years.
SUNY Chancellor John King says the system has seen the largest amount of support in decades under Governor Kathy Hochul, and that's enabling them to maintain their mission of, quote, affordable excellence and an in-state tuition freeze at the four-year campuses.
We had enrollment increases in every sector for the last 3 years. That's the first time we've had back-to-back-to-back enrollment increases in 15 years.
King says he's optimistic about higher education in the face of growing skepticism about its value and funding cuts at the federal level. He says those who earn college degrees still earn more in their lifetimes than those without.
So we're delivering that career value, but we're also delivering incredible economic value to the state.
King says the SUNY Reconnect program, which helps adult learners to go to community college for free, will expand to more high-demand fields and additional campuses next fall. SUNY also received a boost in money to upgrade facilities and is hoping for more funding to continue to do so in the future. In Albany, I'm Samuel King for the New York Public News Network.
And coming up next, we're headed to Pine Bush, where aliens, UFO enthusiasts, and curious visitors filled Main Street for the village's annual UFO fair. This is Radio Chatskill.
On the next Radiolab.
Folks, we're about to march into a massive factory farm.
After openly stealing injured pigs from an industrial farm.
To show the world what's actually happening behind these closed doors.
One activist forces us to put a price on our confusing relationship to animals.
The law says the thing he took has to be worth something.
Like the inherent value of a living thing.
The room was split about 50-50.
What is a pig worth on the next Radiolab?
Wednesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're with Radio Chatskill. For decades, reports of mysterious lights and unexplained objects in the sky have helped make Pine Bush the UFO capital of the East Coast. The Orange County Village has embraced its reputation and created a yearly intergalactic street festival built around decades of those reported sightings. On Saturday, hundreds of people packed the streets of Pine Bush for the 15th annual UFO Fair, a day-long event featuring alien-themed costumes, paranormal partiers, and plenty of community spirit. Reporter Olivia Sipple was there to take in the scene and find out what makes the fair so unique.
Do you believe in paranormal activity? If the answer is yes, Pine Bush might just be the place for you to explore. The 15th annual UFO Fair was underway on June 6th in Pine Bush, with the area known to locals as Area 52. This is not just any ordinary day in Pine Bush. It is a day where paranormal fans, UFOologists, and curious visitors get to explore an area with a deep history of paranormal activity. Some longtime residents of the area remember the early sightings, especially the unsolved mysteries between 1983 and 1986 in the Hudson Valley. More than 5,000 residents during that time reported experiencing something abnormal or seeing something they could not explain. That takes us to Jim Starr, a vendor who has been a part of the fair since the beginning. He explains why the area became known as Area 52.
Apparently there is a some kind of recharging station or something. If you go down 52, on the right-hand side, there's a cemetery, and supposedly there's a triangle underneath there. I think there's three in the world. And one is in, I believe, the UK. The other one is right down here. And then there's one out west somewhere. I don't know where. But and we're on History Channel all the time because of all the UFO sightings in the 80s, which I believe were whatever they were doing over at Stewart Airport. They would bring stuff out at night and then bring it back in the hangar. But you never know. I mean, government just said there's UFOs. And it's a real thing, so. And here we are.
Star is not the only one with these experiences. While a lot of it in Pine Bush is town talk, the Pine Bush UFO Museum on Main Street explains the deep-rooted history that dates back to the early 20th century. Pine Bush is considered the UFO capital of the East Coast, with some of the first sightings documented in the early 1960s. The fair explores the different theories about what may have drawn these reports to the area. For starters, MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, helps research these sightings through field investigators who do on-the-ground work. At the fair, the New Jersey Bureau was trying to reach fairgoers interested in becoming field investigators. Here's David Fritz, a current field investigator for MUFON, New Jersey.
A field investigator goes out and investigates claims. When people file a sighting report in the MUFON, they get separated by states, and then it's sent out to the state director to hand out to the investigators in that state. The investigators get the sighting report, and they have 90 days to complete the investigation. We really don't meet up with people unless we got a couple people to go together and things. But we do investigate on-site investigations, and we do over-the-phone investigations.
One of the speakers, John Wright, is a field investigator himself and even a self-proclaimed skeptic about paranormal activity. He opened his talk by asking the crowd a question.
How many big-time UFO people do we have here? Okay, I got sort of, I got one hand, yeah, I know, and I got one man who's like, yeah, I got it.
He continued with the crowd that seemed unfamiliar with much of the history and began to explain everything they needed to know about Pine Bush's local history and UFO history at large.
All right, so how do we know? APRO, NICAP, these are the two biggest UFO organizations from the 1950s up through the 1970s. They were all over the place, documenting case after case after case. The U.S. government, U.S. Air Force, they brought in a gentleman by the name of Edward Condit. He was Colorado University's physics professor. And they brought him in and they wanted him to look at all these cases, study the physics of everything else that goes with it.
He says their final report left out one of the most famous cases in UFO history.
They give them all kinds of cases. What they believe is their top 10. You know it's not on their top 10 list? Roswell. Didn't even mention it. And these are the people that are the pioneers in UFO research.
The speaker before John Wright took a different approach to UFO research. Robert Stauffer is a literary professor at Dominican University, and his framework is rooted in the idea that literature got there before history did.
Thank you very much. Our argument is that science fiction got there first, and hard. And so these stories that we put together for a book, the idea was that they show how, I mean, there's a book in here, there's a story in here written in 1909 about the machine, a machine that controls the entire world. And one day, it's brought to a stop. And what happens in the ensuing panic?
That offered a very different perspective from Wright's theory, and both speakers gave the crowd contrasting ways to think about the same subject. One fairgoer who moved to the Hudson Valley said she began having her own experiences after arriving here. Samantha Azabal found a community in Pine Bush.
And then I just like started having my own experiences, and I was like, okay, I really need to talk to somebody that doesn't think I'm crazy. Not that anyone's crazy, but it just, you know, I needed to feel like reaffirmed. And then I found out about the UFO museum and went there, and we learned a lot, and they were telling us about this festival. And I couldn't do it last year, and so this year it just worked out, and I'm just excited to be here.
That excitement continued on this particularly warm summer day. The speakers took the stage off to the side under a tent, while vendors filled the main streets of Pine Bush during the fair. There was also a galaxy beauty pageant at the main stage, starting off with the animal and small human category, which included children 12 and younger. That was followed by the regular human category, where participants dressed to impress and took the stage to show off their best looks. In Pine Bush, I'm Olivia Sipple for Radio Catskill.
Next, we'll hear how the legacy of naturalist John Burroughs continues to inspire writers today. Writer and naturalist Irwin Carl joins us to talk about an upcoming plein air writing workshop in Roxbury. This is Radio Catskill.
Hi, Ira Flato here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
President Trump says the U.S. is close to an agreement with Iran to end the war, which could include a new deal about Iran's nuclear program. But what might Trump have to concede?
What he cannot abide is an outcome that paints him to be a loser, having been played by the regime that he intended to weaken.
I'm Elsa Chang. Nuclear negotiations on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered, this afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. For generations, the Catskills have inspired artists, naturalists, and writers, from the painters of the Hudson River School to renowned nature essayist John Burroughs. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke with writer and naturalist Irwin Carl about a unique opportunity to experience that creative tradition firsthand. Carl will lead a plein air writing workshop on Friday at the historic Woodchuck Lodge in Roxbury, combining nature walks, guided observation, and writing exercises designed to help participants draw inspiration from the natural world.
Today we have Irwin Carl. Irwin is on the board of directors of Writers in the Mountains. And Writers in the Mountains is sponsoring a plein air writing workshop. Yes, a plein air writing. We're used to plein air painting, but this is writing.
Correct.
And Irwin is here to tell us about it. And of course, we'll learn a little bit about Irwin himself, too. Hi, Irwin.
Hi, Valerie. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, well, let's begin with the workshop.
Yeah. So it's actually happening this Friday, which is June 12th. So that's coming up quite soon. But yeah, I called it plein air. And everybody's familiar, of course, with plein air painting, where painters set up in a beautiful area, in, you know, immersed in nature, and paint what they see. So this workshop is specifically a very slow, low-impact hiking. We're not climbing any cliffs or anything, slowly going through the forest. And since I do guide mushroom hikes and other naturalist hikes, I will talk about plants, fungi, animals, and the ecosystems, give the participants a little background, but then we'll select areas where we'll stop, hopefully to be inspired by the natural beauty in Roxbury near Woodchuck Lodge, which was one of John Burroughs' residences. I'll do guided writing exercises of this sort of thing you might do like in a classroom or online, but the added benefit of being immersed in the outdoors.
What drew you to this particular idea?
I guess it's kind of different interests I've had going back to childhood, hiking and camping in the Catskills. I'm from the Hudson Valley, so although I was, you know, near where the Catskill Creek went into the Hudson, so I'm technically a river rat, I was always looking at the mountains. And then since we were so close, like going up for skiing, hiking, or other activities, part of my heritage is spending time near and in the Catskills. And I've also been a freelance writer. I started getting paid gigs in high school, so writing is an important part of my identity. And, you know, one of my actual concerns these days is AI, and are writers going to be obsolete? So the people who are, you know, taking writing classes and people who are writers seem to be gravitating towards real life, in-person experiences rather than doing something online or doing something and not knowing if it's ChatGPT, frankly. You know, the two interests of guiding people in the woods, teaching people about the natural systems, but also having done a lot of writing and teaching people how to write, the two just go well together.
And what are your thoughts about AI and writing?
Well, I do edit a monthly arts publication called State of the Art in Andes. And when I get submissions that are written by AI, I can still tell. And whereas a human written article, you might have to cut out 10 or 20%. AI is overwritten by, there's three times as much text there. So you really have to cut out 2/3. But you get the hallucinations or the hiccups. where something just doesn't make sense, and you also have that kind of circular repetitiveness. So for now, I can tell. Like, pretty soon, I probably won't be able to tell. If anybody thought I was important enough, AI could be trained to emulate me. So there could be writing that sounds like my own writing. So soon, it will be hard to distinguish the difference, and I think it's going to create a, you know, we'll be in the matrix, really.
Oh, yes, that matrix. Tell us about that publication briefly.
So it's State of the Art. It's published by the Andes Academy of Art, which is basically kind of a club of art enthusiasts. And we do exhibitions. We do classes on everything from playing the dulcimer to making sculptures with aluminum foil. And we also draw from the figure every week, you know, April to November. So those are activities. You know, we started a publication a couple of years ago, and although it seemed counterintuitive to have a print publication, people responded to it. So it's a one sheet, it's 11 by 17, and we have poetry, microfiction, and images of art and photography, as well as underwriter ads. You know, we distribute it for free throughout Delaware County, mainly near Andes, and some of the venues that distribute it, they call us and like, oh, we run out. So people are still picking up a hard copy and reading a piece of paper in their hands rather than it is also available as a PDF online. But I think a lot of people still want to hold a piece of paper rather than look at a screen.
Tell us about the article you write for the publication.
Yeah. So since the first publication, every issue I write mycophony, and it is a coined phrase, but it's taking my love of mycology, the fungi, and combining it with a symphony or phony. So it's giving voice to fungi and other unseen elements of our environment. So it also includes plants and bacteria that, you know, work with fungi. The topic varies. A lot of times I initially focused on a single species of fungus that's common in the Catskills and, you know, describing where you find it, what it looks like. But I've also done things like we did a 10-day trip into Puerto Rico studying fungi. So that was written up in the last issue. And I've done things like how to cook with fungi. I did one on mushroom poisoning, which is also, as much as we love the world of fungus, there are some poisonous ones that are common even in the Catskills. So, and then I, as a spinoff of that, in association with the one radio show I host is the Farm Hour, and now that alternates with mycophony, so I also do it on the radio.
And I see here you also have written some 10-minute plays.
Oh, yes, the Page to Stage Productions. The next one is actually July 18th and 19th in Stamford, New York. And, it's in association with the Michael Kudish Natural History Preserve. We built a stage on a field next to the preserve. And every year we do submissions from playwrights. The plays are 10 minutes, and they give us a theme. And often I've set them in the Catskills because a sense of place is really kind of integral to my writing, going back to when I was in high school cutting my teeth as a writer.
Before we conclude this conversation, can you give us the time and place of the en plein air writing?
Yeah, so it is Friday, June 12th, and it is from 10 to 3 is the full program, but there is a one-hour lunch break. So people can bring, I'm going to bring a bag lunch and stay there if people want to hang out, but we are, you know, less than 10 minutes from Roxbury if people want to run out and grab, you know, a lunch.
And that's at the John Burroughs Woodchuck Lodge.
Yeah, it is state land and there are public trails. But John Burroughs is an important inspiration for me personally. He essentially pioneered a new type of nature essay where he injected himself as a character and commentary. So up until the late 19th century, there was nature writing that was very scientific or even clinical. But he, you know, included himself, so his personality and his humor and some of his adventures or misadventures in the field kind of underscore some of the points he was making. And some of his essays are about philosophy and are broad ranging, and some of them focus on a particular section of forest or a particular type of bird. You know, and he's become somewhat obscure, but during his lifetime, he was really more popular than Henry David Thoreau. So I do have a connection to him as a writer, and I have done other hikes, like a mushroom hike at Woodchuck Lodge. So it's a pretty special place, and that's where he lived at the end of his life, but it's close to the farm where he grew up. So full circle for him, from 1837 to 1921, he was on the same hill in Roxbury, New York. So that makes the place where we're going to hike the trails also very special.
If folks search for Andy's Academy of Art, will they be able to link to the publication?
Yes. The only thing, it is under Streamside Yoga, which is the building where we have most of our activities. But if you search on it, you'll go right to the main page. And then there's a list of all our archived issues of State of the Art. And you can click on a calendar of upcoming events on that page.
Yeah. Okay. If a listener is interested in joining the workshop coming up on Friday, how would they go about doing that?
So you can go to the website writersinthemountains.org. So that has all the workshops. Also, we have an open mic on Thursdays, including this week on the 11th is one of them. Yeah, all the information you need to register for all the classes is on a page on writersinthemountain.org.
Okay, well, have fun, Erwin.
Yeah, I hope to see some of the listeners out there on the trails.
Thanks to you, culture reporter Valerie Manzi. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder to sign up for Radio Catskill's free weekly newsletter. Stay connected and informed with the latest local news, culture, and more delivered to your inbox every Friday. Just go to the website, wjffradio.org, and click and sign up, and you'll get it this Friday. That's all for us today. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills. From inpatient and outpatient care to primary, urgent, and specialty care with Garnet Health doctors in Sullivan County. Exceptional lives here. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA. It's been 10 years since a mass shooting at the gay nightclub, Pulse, in Orlando, Florida. We speak with a survivor.
Sometimes when I close my eyes, I see when I was on the floor.
And look at what's changed for LGBTQ plus people since then. That's this week on Latino USA. Thursday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
This week's Retro Cocktail Hour has stereo overstimulation, the exotic sounds of the Voodoo Five, and a weekend in Waikiki with the Tiki Yaki Orchestra. I'm Darryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, sunny and very warm, a high of 83. Tonight's low, 62. There might be a shower in places later on. Looking at thunderstorms moving into the area on Wednesday, particularly in the evening, and then into Thursday, we'll see heavier thunderstorms. Wednesday's high, 77. Thursday's high, 83. And warming up to 91 for Friday, with another possibility of some of those afternoon and evening thunderstorms. On Point is coming up next.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Will-O-Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange, Sullivan, and Rockland, a publicly supported philanthropic institution. Information at CFOSRNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Feel like you're just spinning in an endless whirlpool of information? We can help steady you.
I'm Brooke Gladstone, co-host of On the Media, and we point out where you should be paying attention and what you can afford to ignore. Using the media as a lens on our world, we reveal nuance and detail often missed by other outlets. So don't miss On the Media, Saturday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF, Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill.